off, we finished up 1 Samuel. Now we're in 2 Samuel. The author, or authors, plural, of 2 Samuel is possibly, you know, we don't know for sure, but possibly Nathan the prophet and Gad the prophet. Remember, we brought up a passage, 1 Chronicles 29:29, which mentions that Samuel the prophet, Nathan the prophet, and Gad the prophet, God inspired them to record Israel's history during this time. So, now Samuel the prophet himself was dead by the time 2 Samuel came about, but 1 and 2 Samuel probably got its name from the fact that Samuel wrote the first portion of 1 Samuel until he died, and then maybe Nathan the prophet, who was a prophet during the time of David, picked it up from there, and then Gad after him. It was written, 2 Samuel was written between 1011 BC and 971 BC, and it covers the main events of David's 40-year reign as king over Israel. Now, outline of 2 Samuel, real easy, just a two-point outline here. The first four chapters is David's reign in Hebron. He reigns over Judah. Remember that the nation of Israel was divided. They had a civil war later on in history and was divided with Judah and the south after Solomon had died. And Rehoboam was his son, took over. You had the 10 northern tribes became the nation of Israel, and they split off from Judah and Benjamin in the south. Well, even before that split occurred, there wasn't a total feeling of unity, even during the time of Saul. Okay? If Saul did anything, he managed to unify the northern tribes pretty good. And even though he ruled over Judah and Israel, he ruled over all 12 tribes, they still really weren't solidified until David. But when David first became king, he ruled only the two southern tribes for 7 years. And then for the next 33 years, he took control of Israel and ruled over all of Israel for the final 33 years. So he ruled for 40 years. The first seven was in Hebron. So the first part is David's rule over Hebron, rule over Judah from Hebron. Here's where Hebron is on our map in Judah. And then David ruled in Jerusalem over all Israel in chapters 5 to 24, which takes us to the end of 2 Samuel. So a very easy outline there. And it's remaining 33 years. He had 7 years in Hebron and 33 from Jerusalem. By the way, he had to defeat the Jebusites in Jerusalem because the Jebusites, who were Canaanites from before the Israelites went into the Promised Land, Joshua didn't knock them off. The judges didn't knock him off, and Saul didn't knock him off. And so David had to defeat the city and then take Jerusalem. But the Israelites never ruled it until David came along. Yeah.
Well, during this entire time, from the divided kingdom came about during the time of the judges, right?
No. The divided kingdom came after Solomon's son died. But there was... what is called the divided kingdom did not occur until after David's grandson, Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, took over. That's what they call the divided kingdom. But when David assumed leadership after Saul died, Saul the first king, you had the division between Judah and Israel, but it wasn't yet really called a divided kingdom in the strictest sense. So you could say, yes, there was a divided kingdom, but it wasn't the divided kingdom that we talk about today. Well, we'll get to that. That's when Solomon...
No. Said there was already a kind of a division.
Oh, yeah. A lot of jealousy because, you know, Judah was kind of the focus and all, and especially later on when the temple got in Jerusalem. But they're just, in other words, when Saul died, if there had been perfect unity, then either Saul's son would have ruled all Israel or David would have ruled all Israel. But when he died, a portion sided with David, and the rest, the 10 northern tribes, sided with Saul's son, one of Saul's sons. So, and we're going to go through that and all. But in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, David mourns for Saul and Jonathan. Even though Saul was his enemy and tried to kill him and was jealous of him, David still respected him as God's anointed one, and David felt bad for him. But Jonathan was a very, very close friend of David, loved David like a brother, would have died for David. Picture yourself, the word is out, Samuel the prophet anointed a guy who's going to be the next king of Israel, and your name is Jonathan, and your father Saul is the king, and you're supposed to be the next king, and he anoints the next king, and it's not you. And then, it's got nothing to do, you're a very godly man, it's got nothing to do with anything you did. It's just that your father messed up, so the royal line is no longer going to flow from Solomon, from Saul. And you'd have every incentive to be jealous of and to hate David, yet Jonathan loved him just the same. So then Jonathan was a tremendously godly man and a tremendous warrior, a good friend of David, and helped save David's life on several occasions. So David mourned for Saul and Jonathan in chapter 1. In chapter 2, Ishbosheth, pretty much he pronounces like his spelled, it's Ishbosheth. And he's the son of Saul. He reigns over Israel. So he reigns over Israel to the north after Saul dies. But David is reigning in Hebron over Judah, the southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Now Abner was the commander in Saul's army, and he sought to make David king over all Israel in chapter 3. Now Joab, the commander of David's army, you'd think he'd be happy, but he's feeling, look, if Abner comes in here, Joab was very power hungry, by the way, and Joab, just a one rotten apple, tremendous warrior, but a rotten apple, and he's going to get his. We'll see that later on, not in this book, but later on we'll see it. But Joab was David's commander. And he thought, and he was very power hungry, if David wasn't the warrior that he was and wasn't so beloved, he would have probably tried to have overthrown David, I would think. Very power hungry. And Joab sees the commander of Saul's army wanting to make David king, so Joab ends up murdering Abner. And so this Joab, even if you're for us, but you might get promoted above me, I'll kill you. And that's pretty much the way Joab was. He killed a lot of innocent people throughout. But in chapter 4, Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, is murdered by his own men. And so now their government is in turmoil. And so what David does, David then begins to reign in Jerusalem. He moves his headquarters to Jerusalem and reigns over all Israel for 33 years. So his first four chapters were... take up 7 years, and now David reigned over all Israel for the next 33 years. Chapter 5, David captures Jerusalem. He defeats the Jebusites, who had been in there From before the time the Jews entered into the Promised Land, before the Israelites entered into the Promised Land, yeah.
I have a question about Melchizedek, that you said from 3 feet down. Was he part of the Jebusites?
I don't know. I don't know when they came into there. I'd have to do some checking up. But it's funny you ask about Melchizedek, because I just mentioned today's study. We're on Hebrews, and we're going to be talking about Melchizedek for weeks to come. And then in Hebrew, I'm in Genesis on Friday night, so we're going to be talking about Melchizedek. But he was the king of Salem, and Salem means peace. Well, Jerusalem means new peace. And scholars tell us that Salem, that Jerusalem, was the same city as Salem. They changed the name when they rebuilt the city. So Melchizedek is a type of Christ in that he was the king of Israel, king of Jerusalem at a time before there were even any Israelites other than Abraham was alive at that time. But that'd be interesting to check into. One thing that's real interesting is that the kings of Israel were often considered philosopher kings. So that when Solomon came in, they would talk about him being wiser than any of the other kings from Israel, the other kings of Jerusalem from the past. And they're talking like before David and all. But even David was kind of a philosopher type king. Some of his psalms get very philosophical, and they're talking about how the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands, and things of that sort. But I have to check up on that. But David captures Jerusalem in chapter 5. He brings the ark to Jerusalem in chapter 6. Now remember, it was in Shiloh. The ark had been in Shiloh with the tabernacle. And now David brings it all. Can't find it on this map. Don't see it on this map, but I know I've got a few maps with it on there, but where exactly Shiloh is, but he brings the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem, and he dances and everything. He's so happy about it. And his wife, Saul's daughter, had a problem with that and laughed and all, and God was real upset with her for that. But he brings the Ark into Jerusalem, and there's a tremendous celebration. And then in chapter 7 comes the Davidic covenant, God's covenant with David. So take a look at 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 to 16. And God's speaking to David, and God says, "When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom." Now, God is talking about Solomon, but he's talking about Solomon as a type of Christ. So some of the things that he says are going to apply both to Solomon and to Christ, but some of the things are only going to apply to Solomon, and some of them are only going to apply to Christ. We've got to read it real close. He shall build, obviously, verse 12 can apply to either Solomon or the Messiah, Jesus, who came much later. "He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Well, Solomon built the temple, but Jesus is also going to build a millennial temple when he returns. It says, "I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Solomon's throne is established forever only through the Messiah, so indirectly it applies to Solomon, but directly it applies to Christ, who will reign forever. Verse 14, "I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity," obviously that applies only to Solomon, "I will correct him with the rod of men and the throats of the sons of men." So Solomon ended up getting into false worship, married many wives, 300 wives, 700 concubines, worshipped false gods. "But my loving kindness shall not depart from him as I took it away from Saul." You see, because of Saul's sin, the godly line, the messianic line, or the royal line, would move from Saul to David's line, okay? But God was saying, I'm not going to take my anointing away from Saul's line, because it's from David, and the Messiah is going to come from there. My loving kindness should not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and all this vision, so Nathan the prophet, spoke to David. So possibly one of our authors here, Nathan the prophet, spoke these words of God, the message that God had for David, the Davidic covenant. And that's why we know that Jesus, the Messiah, had to be from the line of David to sit on the throne. David defeats the Philistines, the Moabites, and Syria in chapter 8. The Philistines were down here at this time, but I think later on they moved on up. But they were on the coast, the west coast there, right bordering the Mediterranean Sea, and he was defeated them in battle. And the Moabites were down here. Ruth was from Moab. We had the Moabites, and then also the Syrians, who were more to the northeast, I believe. But at times their kingdom would come down further. But we're going to see that David pretty much was a tremendous warrior, and the nation of Israel just was increasing dramatically in its land. And coming closer and closer to that which God promised to Abraham, because God promised to Abraham much more land than we see today in that Israel owns today, and that Israel had when David took it over. But the exact amount of that land, though, is going to be fully taken by Christ in the Millennium Kingdom, or with God's wrath right before the Millennium Kingdom starts. Chapter 9 of 2 Samuel, David befriends Jonathan's crippled son. Everybody was expecting David to kill this guy because he was from Saul's line. He might rise up and make a claim to the throne. David says, no way am I going to kill this guy. And David ended up taking this guy and sitting him down. Whenever they would have feasts, this guy would sit right next to him in a seat of honor at David's feast. And with David, you will find there's so many people that try to take warriors. They say, oh, you know, you got to be a new age, no nuker pacifist before you can have any sensitivity towards one of the most sensitive men who ever lived. Read 1st and 2nd Samuel, and you will find David was one of the most sensitive men who ever lived. That's why he was a man after God's own heart. I mean, this guy was not only a warrior who killed Goliath and killed multitudes of people, the greatest warrior in the history of Israel, but he was also a poet and a songwriter. And he was also a man, when he loved to the uttermost. And he loved Jonathan, and he missed Jonathan, and the only way he could continue to express his love for Jonathan was to take care of Jonathan's crippled son. So most kings would do what was politically expedient. They would have killed this guy. They would have executed him. David was a man of compassion and ended up giving him a position of honor. Chapter 10, David defeats the Ammonites and the Syrians. So again, he battles the Syrians again. Here's Ammon over here. So the Ammonites are over here to the east. Chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11. This should be a lesson. This chapter here should be a lesson to each and every preacher. It should be a lesson to each and every Christian in their walk with the Lord. Paul said that don't be so confident that you stand lest you fall. He talked about it, I believe it was 1 Corinthians. Don't get so confident that you think you're above sin. David was a man after God's own heart, and when we see the sins that he was guilty of, we should really have tremendous respect for the Lord and really trust in the Lord to give us victory over sinfulness in our lives. But take a look in verses 1 to 5 of 2 Samuel chapter 11. Then it happened in the spring at the time when kings go out to battle that David sent Joab, that was his commander, and his servants with him and all Israel, and destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. So kings are going out to battle, and what is David? He's a king, and what is he doing? He's staying at Jerusalem. When we're not doing what God called us to do, watch out, because it's very easy to get in trouble. If God is calling you to go evangelize people on the street, you say, I'm just going to kick back at home. Watch out. You might be afraid, well, I might get in trouble on the street. Hey, if you're on the streets doing God's will, you're safer there, less prone to temptation than you are in the privacy of your own home, sitting down, picking your nose. If you're not doing what God's called you to do, and you've got a bunch of idle time on your hands, watch out. I recommend you fill your schedule with godly things to do, whatever it is God's calling you to do. Verse 2. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked away. He couldn't sleep. You know why? When you're not working, you're not tired. When you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're just not going to be tired. He couldn't sleep. Maybe he even had some guilt. He's a warrior and he's not out there fighting battles, but all his men are out there ready to die for him. David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. She figured, hey, it's the middle of the night. All the men are off to fighting in the mountain war, and I could take a bath out here, and no one will see me. So it's from the roof of the king's palace, and he sees a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And say something about Uriah the Hittite. Uriah the Hittite was one of, I believe it was one of David's 30 mighty men. One of his commandos. One of the guys that was willing to die for him and would have given his right arm in a heartbeat for David. As loyal as they come. A mighty warrior, but someone who literally died for David and risked his life for David on many occasions. Verse 4, and David sent, you know, David just said, well, hands off. Even if David was going to be, he's already married, even if he was going to be, you know, at that time, kings were taking more wives than one, which is wrong, obviously. But even if he was going to be that ruthless, you would think he would at least respect his old friend, Uriah the Hittite. Verse 4, and David sent messengers and took her. When she came to him, he lay with her. Now, Bathsheba, it's wrong to have adultery, to commit adultery, but I will say this. If anybody, the guilty party here is David more than anybody else, because he had all the authority of the king. She knew all he had to do was give the command, and people would have stoned her without asking any questions. And so a lot more pressure on her than David. David was the instigator here. He lay with her, and when she had purified herself from uncleanness, the Jewish ceremonial washings, she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, and she sat and told David and said, I am pregnant. The Bible says a man reaps what he sows. Here's David, the king of Israel, and doesn't sound like a man after God's own heart. If a man after God's own heart can stoop to that level, who the heck are we to think that we're above sin? Yeah.
That's pretty tough. So can you amplify the meaning of a man after God's own heart?
What it meant pretty much was it was a man who desired the heart is the center of a man's being, and so the heart is like the center of God. He desired to be as close to God as possible, to do that which God wanted him to do, to be like God, to fellowship with God, to it was like he was just so enraptured with God, so in love with God that God was the controlling force of his life. It's like if a guy really falls in love with a girl and wants to marry her, he's a man after her heart. We talk about giving a hand in marriage, but it's like a man after her heart. Well, David was a man after God's own heart. No, you couldn't give a man a bigger compliment than that, and in all the scriptures, it's probably the greatest compliment. Moses was called the meekest man who ever lived, but David being called a man after God's own heart means, I mean, if anybody is not going to fall, it would be David. But here, even a man after God's own heart. And I think, too, more than is being a warrior. It was those songs that he wrote for the Lord and the worship. That's why I try to get into our people's heads. When you worship Jesus, it's not fun and games. It's not words bouncing off the ceiling. It's time to take your shoes off. You're standing on holy ground. And David knew worship. David was all wrapped up in worship. But even a man after God's own heart can take a nosedive, so who are we to think that we're above sin? So David, now he commits adultery. Look at verses 14 and 17. Now it came about in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab, that's his commander, and sent it by the hand of Uriah. Oh, by the way, the verses in between, decides, well, if I can get Uriah to come back from battle and to spend the night with his wife and have sex with her, then he'll think it's his kid when he goes back to battle and comes back after battle and he's got a kid. He'll think it's his kid and there'll be no scandal. Uriah says, hey, I can't do it, David. I can't do it, Almighty King. Shall I sleep in my bedroom with my wife when the sons of Israel are sleeping under the stars and risking their lives? So he slept outside of David's palace with the animals and with the servants. This man was loyal. This man was about as loyal as they come. And so David says, okay, change 22. I got to make another plan so that I don't have to reap what I sow. So what did David do? David gets this guy killed. Verses 14 and 17. Now it came about in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he had written in the letter saying, place Uriah. Believe me, Joab would do this and not blink an eye. Joab could care less about killing innocent people. Place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. So it was as Joab kept watch on the city that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city were out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Technically speaking, what is David guilty of? David is guilty of adultery and murder. And even a man after God's own heart could take that kind of nosedive. Chapter 12, Nathan the prophet confronts David and gives him a parable about a guy that was wealthy and had lots of sheep, and there was one poor man who only had one sheep. And the guy who had everything killed the guy and took his one sheep from him. David said, let his punishment be sevenfold upon his head. Nathan the prophet pointed to David and said, behold the man. I tell you, man, we a prophet. So many people today try to claim to be prophets. If you are a prophet, man, courage, it comes with the office. Here his prophet is, might not even own a sword to his name, and he points at the king of Israel and say, you are the man. You are that ruthless lowlife, and you just pronounce your own punishment. Because David was a man after God's own heart, he crumpled in front of his prophet because he recognized the prophet. I'm a king, I'm above this man, but God is speaking through this man, and God is above me. What do I have to do to get right with God? And make a long story short, David's son eventually dies. David was mourning for the kid when the kid was born sickly, and mourned for him for 7 days, and then the kid died on the seventh day, which is the day before you get circumcised, and which is the eighth day. And then they said, then David stopped mourning, and they said, why'd you stop mourning? Your son just died. He said, because I thought when I was mourning, I was calling out to God, I thought maybe God would spare him since it was my sin, but when God took him, I know that he can't come to me, but I will go to him someday. So David knew that his little baby went to heaven. But a man reaps what he sows, and even if you're a man after God's own heart, you're going to reap what you sow. None of us are immune to sin. Chapters 13 and 14, David's son Amnon raped his half-sister Tamar. And her brother Absalom, also a son of David, gets ticked off. And so Absalom murders Amnon out of revenge. Okay? Let's see, look at chapter 14, verse 28. Let me see if we need to read this verse. Running behind already. Let's see. After Absalom killed his brother for raping his sister, his half-brother for raping his sister, now Absalom lived two full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. 2 years he's living in the same city, and David wasn't even going to talk to him. So this guy's getting bitter. Also take a look at verse 33. So when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face on the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So finally they're brought together. Unfortunately, there's still some dissension there, and Absalom is a rebellious son. And take a look at chapters 15 to 17. Absalom then rebels against David, and David has to flee Jerusalem. Look at verse 6 of chapter 15. And in this manner Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. People who want to talk to the king, Absalom would say, well, the king has no time for you, but I'll listen to your complaint. Man, too bad I'm not the king. If I was the king, I'd take care of all your complaints. And he started to win the hearts of people and steer them away from King David, his father. Verses 13 and 14, then a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. And David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. By the way, Absalom was a mighty warrior, and he was also an extremely good-looking young man, according to the scriptures. He had every quality you needed to be a great leader, Absalom had. Arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. The mightiest king in Israel's history, and now he's running from his own son, because that military he built up, and a lot of the people of Israel are siding with his son and not with him. And he's still got those commandos on his side, so that are loyal with him till death, even though he wasn't always as loyal to them as he should be. But Absalom rebels against David in chapters 15 to 17. David says, you know, don't kill Absalom, my son, chapter 18. Don't kill him. Bring him back alive and all. What does Joab do? Absalom's riding. The battle's turning in David's favor. And Absalom gets his long, he had long hair. Very good looking man with long hair. He got his hair caught in a tree, pulled him off his horse, and now he's hanging from his hair from the tree. And Joab walks up and throws a spear or two into his chest and kills him. And David distinctly said, I want him back alive. And here's Joab again. What's Joab thinking? David's going to forgive this kid, and this kid's going to be the next king of Israel. And so Joab decides, I want to be king. Joab's got his own hidden agenda, and he kills Absalom. And Absalom's army is defeated. In that chapter 18, David just came all apart, it seems. He's supposed to rejoice, we won the battle. And David is weeping all over the place. And Joab's pretty much saying, stand up and act like we won, for crying out loud. These guys fought their hearts out for you. And Joab has zero mercy, zero feelings. And there's David, who when he loves to the uttermost. And his son is dead, and he was just tremendously crushed. David returns to Jerusalem, and David gives Joab's position. He's fed up with Joab, so he gives Joab's position as commander to Amasa, a guy named Amasa. So that leads to chapter 20. Joab murders Amasa. Okay? You could disagree with Joab. You just couldn't disagree with him and live. Okay? Joab was not Not somebody you'd like to argue with, okay? He was one of David's mighty men. He was a bad dude. But if you disagreed with him, you crossed him, you were dead. If he thought that you might get promoted above him, you were dead. You walked within a 20-foot radius of him, you were dead. And then Joab defeats Sheba's revolt, and the revolt, and Joab knocks it down, suppresses it. In chapter 21, David appeases the Gibeonites by executing 7 of Saul's family. Now, remember the Gibeonites, when the Israelites were supposed to wipe out all of the Canaanites, when they took the promised land, well, the Gibeonites threw dust on themselves and on all their belongings and pretended they were nomads who just happened to wander into Canaan. They said, oh, well, don't kill us. We're really not Canaanites. We'll be your slaves. You know, you guys got a few million people. You can wipe us out. We'll be your slaves. And so Joshua and the Israelites made an agreement with them. Then they find out these guys are lying through their teeth. They really were Canaanites. They lived in the land of Canaan, but they couldn't go back on the vow that they made, so they lived in the land. Well, what did Saul do when he became king? He started slaughtering them. And so they said, well, you know, we were unjustly slaughtered, so to appease them, David ended up killing 7 of Saul's family. That was a common practice. The Bible doesn't condone it, but it was a common practice back then. If somebody makes a mistake, you throw him, his kids, his wife, his servants, you take everybody, and they all get executed. Chapter 21... 2 Samuel 21, verses 15 to 22. We are way behind right now, but there's some Philistine giants, and there's some real interesting stuff. I'll read it. Now when the Philistines were at war with Israel, Philistines had a bunch of giants, not just Goliath. David went down and his servants with them, and as they fought against the Philistines, David became weary. Now, he's getting up in years, and he's getting a little tired. Then Ishbi-Benob, you know, decent name for a kid, who was among the descendants of the giant. So he was among the giants. He was either a son or a nephew or whatever, but most likely he was a son of Goliath. The weight of whose spear was 300 shekels of bronze in weight was girded with a new sword, and he intended to kill David. Well, none of these giants were bigger than their daddy, Goliath. Goliath was a lot bigger than them. You can compare that by the amount of the weight of their equipment and stuff. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, helped him and struck the Philistine and killed him. I think he was one of David's mighty men as well. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, you shall not go out again with us to battle, that you may not extinguish the lamp of Israel. These guys are so loyal to David. They were saying, David, if you get killed, the light in Israel is going to go out, and we ain't going to have a reason to fight anymore. Stay home, we'll do the fighting for you. These guys, they loved him so much. It was one battle where David said, man, what I wouldn't give for a handful of water from that pool in Bethlehem. And so 2 of his guys sneak behind enemy lines and come back with some water for him. And he said, what is this? And they said, we got you some of that water that you wanted. And David looked at that water and said, that's too precious. I can't drink it. And he poured it onto the ground because he said, I'm not worthy to drink that water. But I mean, these guys, literally, they were about as loyal as you could possibly get. That's how loyal they were to David. Verse 18, now it came about after this that there was war again with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibekai, the Hushathite, struck down Saph, who was among the descendants of the giant. And there was war with the Philistines again at Gob. And Elhanan, the son of General Oregon, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite, that's Goliath Jr., the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And there was war at Gath again, and there was a man of great stature, this is my favorite one, a man of great stature who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot, 24 in number, and he also had been born to the giant. Giant had some weird kids. And when he defied Israel, Jonathan the son of Shimei, David's brother, struck him down. These 4 were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. So, you know, they were constantly fighting giants, not just when they went into the promised land, but throughout the history of Israel. Those are just some of the battles that they had there with some of the Philistine giants. David's last words are recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 23. Also, some of his mighty men are mentioned, some of their background and stuff, and crazy stuff, man. The crazy stuff about some of these guys. And David's sins by counting his troops is really not real clear exactly what the sin was here. Verse 1 says, "Now the anger of the Lord burned against Israel and incited David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah." Verse 9, "And Joab gave the number of the registration of the people to the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Israel were 500,000 men." So you had almost 1.5 million warriors alone. And they were counted in the census. Maybe God wanted them just to trust in him and not in their forces. I don't know. But verse 10, "Now David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have acted very foolishly." And then verse 15, "So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning until the appointed time, and 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died." And again, it's real unclear exactly what it was. Maybe he was just trusting in the power of his military, whatever. But David is going to die real quick here in 1 Kings. And we're about out of time, so I'm going to go right into the next lecture and pick up 1 Kings.